Today we come to the final instalment of Gordon Simpson's diaries, aptly entitled Finale.
Towards the end of Freddie Laker's time with BUA, he did a deal with the manufacturers to buy three VC-10s, which were the latest thing in jet aeroplanes. I doubt he paid much for them, in view of the fact that the only other company in the world that bought VC-10s was BOAC. He was more or less taking them off his hands. Once again, an English aircraft was far too thirsty and not very economical to run, a pity because it was a lovely aircraft to look at and fly. It had one of the biggest flight decks I've ever come across, bags of room up front, and because the engines were at the rear, it was comparatively quiet to fly in. There'd been an agreement between the various airlines that BOAC should have the larger share of the Empire routes and the North Atlantic, while British Caledonian should have the East and West African and the South American routes. VC-10s mostly flew to South America, and we were very popular down there. The locals used to call us BUA, and they liked the planes, so we did well on these flights. Later on, we were allowed to operate the North Atlantic routes as well, so we had a regular service to New York and also one to Los Angeles. The flight to Los Angeles meant flying along the Great Circle, which meant you didn't go direct across as it looks on a map. You went right up into the Arctic area and then down again the other side. As far as navigation went, this was a tricky thing, because above a certain latitude, the compasses don't work properly, as they point down towards the magnetic north rather than horizontally. Therefore, a new form of navigation had to be used. I won't go into it in detail, as it was rather complicated and even confused the pilots, but it meant we had to work like dingbats, virtually 8 hours on a 10-hour flight to make the necessary calculations.
I do remember one pilot who was on his first trip on that route saying when we landed how marvellous it was and that Gordon had disconnected us from the Earth altogether. The thing was that instead of giving courses as you normally would, say, north, south, east or west, on this particular form of navigation, you could be travelling what we think is west, but in fact giving a course to the pilot that was southeast or something like that, because it didn't bear any relationship to the actual Earth directions. Normally the flights were very smooth on the VC-10 and we thoroughly enjoyed them. One of our captains said, what a marvellous job this was. The company gives us a £3 million taxi to take us from party to party. The only snag being that it is self-drive. We did have a couple of incidents that stick in my memory. On one occasion we were taking off from Gatwick and after takeoff, when we raised the wheels, an indicator on the instrument panel, which showed the position of the wheels, had a red light indicating that one of the wheels was not up. We wondered what the score was and circled around and asked the tower to tell us whether the wheel was down or not, and they said there was no sign of a wheel. We thought we had better not proceed until it had been checked, and so we came back and landed. This meant flying around to dump some fuel until we reached landing weight. It appeared that the undercarriage went down okay, but we were still a bit doubtful as the wheel light hadn't changed, so we had to prepare for what might have been a crash landing. The captain ordered the stewardesses to prime the escape chutes at both doors, just in case they were needed. That was all very well, but the stewardess doing the front door not only primed the chute, but managed to operate it so that it inflated inside the cabin, which was a bit frightening for first-class passengers. Anyway, the chutes weren't needed as we landed successfully, and they soon sorted out the instrument problem and got us away okay.
The other incident was over South America, when we were flying from Buenos Aires to Santiago. This involved crossing the Andes, which at that point were about 20, 22,000 feet high. Obviously, we had to keep well above that height and then let down very quickly into Santiago on the other side. You'll be familiar with turbulence encountered with when flying, but there's also something called clear air turbulence, which can appear over mountainous areas. No one knew what caused it, and therefore no one was able to predict when you're going to experience it. I'd crossed the Andes several times before, never come across it, but on this occasion, We hit this clear air turbulence and it literally threw the plane up and down 2,000 or 3,000 feet. It was really frightening. The captain was a good skipper and he managed to hold the airplane reasonably steady in between these height and speed variations. The Mach meter was going through Mach 1 at one stage. The funny part about it was that being completely unexpected, we hadn't even got the passengers strapped in by the time we first experienced it. Well, eventually they got the passengers strapped in and I remember seeing the chief steward come through the cabin door, and as he did so, a big basket of rolls fell on him and he fell on the floor. Anyway, we got into Santiago all right and had an inspection of the aeroplane, which didn't seem to be damaged in any way. However, it is rather significant that on the next couple of trips, that particular aeroplane didn't seem to be as efficient as it had been. You couldn't get the same speed out of it. This was eventually put down to the fact that the turbulence had upset the tailplane, probably deformed it in some way, possibly only by a matter of centimetres, but enough to affect the efficiency of the aircraft.
Soon after Caledonian took over, they decided the VC-10 wasn't economical for them, so they sold them and bought Boeing 707s instead. According to the pilots, it was like going from a Rolls-Royce to a Ford tractor. The 707 was a serviceable enough aeroplane, but not as comfortable as the VC-10. Anyway, I saw my time out on the 707s and was eventually made redundant again, although it wasn't the pilots this time, but the introduction of navigational aids. They didn't have GPS then, but they did have what they called inertial navigation systems, which had been perfected on spacecraft. Although a very expensive device to fit, they reckoned it was cheaper to do than keep navigators going, so it marked the end of my flying career. Before I finish, I thought it might be interesting to look back over the 90-odd years I've lived and to see the progress that's been made in practically all fields. So if I compare it with things as they were when I was, say, 5 years old to present day, it'll be quite remarkable in many ways. I'll start at home. In the kitchen, for instance, there were no such things as fridges in those days. Any perishable food we used to keep in what was called a safe, which was virtually just a box with gauze over the front, and you put it in the coolest place in the larder and hoped it would last a few days. This, of course, meant that shopping was more frequent, probably 2 or 3 times a week. There were no washing machines. Everything was washed in the sink, then put through a mangle, a device with 2 rollers and a handle you turned, to squeeze out the water before hanging the items on a line to dry.
There was no hot water on tap, only what you could boil up on the stove, as there were no hot water systems. Domestic central heating hadn't been invented at the time. Most people had coal or log fires, with all the inconvenience involved in bringing in the coal, taking the ash out the next morning. There was another form of heating, which did come in a bit later, where you could have a hot water container at the back of your open fire, so that would heat the water up. But it only had a rather small capacity. There were no such things as microwaves or toasters. Toasted bread consisted of putting bread on a toasting fork and holding it in front of the fire to brown. As far as transport was concerned, only the rich could afford a car. Most people walked, used public transport or bicycles. Even the deliveries of coal, milk and bread came in horse-powered carts. The milkman used to have a big container of milk on the back of his cart, and we had jugs which held half a pint or a quart, which would take out for the milkman to fill. In Bournemouth, public transport was mostly trams, which went all over the town. I remember that Tuckton Bridge used to be a toll bridge, and at that time was practically in the middle of the country. When you came along on the tram, you had to pay an extra halfpenny to go over the bridge. Fares were ridiculously cheap compared to today. From Charminster into Bournemouth, for example, was 1.5 old pennies.
As far as entertainment was concerned, there was no television, computers or anything like that. When I was 5 years old, radio was just beginning to come in, but this was very basic. Previous to that, entertainment was self-made, most houses having pianos and therefore sing-songs as entertainment. There was, however, plenty of outdoor entertainment. I seem to remember there were about 5 theatres in Bournemouth, but not many cinemas, as they were only just coming in. And the only cinema that I remember going to only showed black and white silent films, mostly of the cowboy variety. But there were plenty of theatres. There was a theatre on each pier, the Pavilion, the Theatre Royal, the Little Theatre, which was an amateur dramatic company, and the Hippodrome at Boscombe, which was a sort of musical variety type theatre. As far as post was concerned, we were a lot better off than we are now. We used to have at least two deliveries a day, including one on Sunday, and I think there were three, if not four, collections from most post boxes, and a penny or a penny halfpenny stamp guaranteed delivery for the next day. There were no telephones except in big offices. To contact someone in a hurry, there was a telegraph service. You could go to the post office and write out a telegram, which cost so much per word. They would then telegraph it to the post office nearest the recipient. And if you did it before 3 o'clock, they would guarantee delivery that day. You'd quite often see telegraph boys, as they used to be called, on bikes, and they had uniforms with little pillbox hats. Obviously, there were no supermarkets. Those didn't come in till after the Second World War. However, Sainsbury's were in existence, and they had a branch in Bournemouth Town Centre. Most branches were exactly the same. They had marble floors and marble counters. One side was all the dry goods. The other side was meat, butter, sugar, etc. And at the far end was the cashier's desk. So you went along and got what you wanted and took it to the cashier, who would cash it up for you. The average suburb like Tuckton would have just a grocer, greengrocer, or a post office maybe, and that's about all. You could go into town for the bigger shops. There were bigger department stores which dealt mostly in clothes and household furniture and goods. Finally, things like computers and the internet were things of the far future. We hadn't even heard the word. The nearest you had to a computer was what banks and some firms had called an add-in machine, which was a purely mechanical device, which did things you could do for yourself, only a bit quicker.
That brings us to the end of Gordon's diaries.